You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the Syria crisis takes a new twist. Israeli fighter planes appear to have attacked targets on the Lebanon-Syria border. We're in Jerusalem for the latest. Angela Merkel's glide to re-election has hit choppy waters. Quentin Peel explains how.
For the first time in a while, people are suddenly saying, well, maybe a red-green government of Social Democrats and Greens might be an alternative to Angela Merkel.
Acid attacks, intrigue and a fleeing ballerina. The drama offstage at the Bolshoi is no surprise, according to a new book on ballet's theatrical past in Russia. And then we're in Bilbao to meet the world's best mayor.
I have committed to my city, and I will have commitment until I fizzle out. A commitment to my people.
All that, plus a song or two, maybe a Scottish song, why not? All to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But before any of that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. Israeli jets have attacked a suspected weapons convoy on the border of Syria and Lebanon. Reports say the strike happened overnight as the convoy was on its way into Syria. Three squadrons of four jets carried out three separate sorties against the convoy, hitting it near the Lebanese village of Nabi Chit, about halfway up the border with Syria in central Lebanon. Police have charged a British man with the stabbing to death of a mother of three in the south of France. A search was launched after 34-year-old Yudia Zimat failed to collect her three-year-old daughter from school in Nîmes. 32-year-old Robert Plant was arrested after police carried out house-to-house inquiries. Police sniffer dogs later discovered the woman's body. The United Nations World Food Programme is calling on the international community to help save hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees from hunger. The Syrian Arab Red Crescent says more than 2.5 million Syrians inside the country need food assistance. The WFP is reaching people inside Syria in both areas controlled by the government and by rebel forces. But the agency says needs are growing ever greater, with serious bread and fuel shortages across the country. WFP Executive Director Atharin Cousin, who's been visiting Zaatari refugee camp in Jordan, says the international community must act collectively.
This is a challenge that the entire global community must work together to address. No child should go hungry because of the conflict in Syria, and no one country is responsible for ensuring that that child receives the support that he or she needs. We must all work together.
Police have gathered near a house in rural Alabama in the United States, where a man's believed to be holding a six-year-old child hostage in an underground shelter. The standoff has been going on throughout the night after the man, whose name has not been released by police, boarded the school bus in Midland City and shot the driver dead. Officers say the man shot him when he refused to let the child off the bus. The sheriff's office have named the driver as 66-year-old Charles Poland Jr., who'd been working for the Dale County Board of Education since 2009. The US economy shrank by an equivalent annual rate of 0.1% in the last quarter of 2012. It's the first contraction announced by the US Commerce Department since the 2009 global recession. The figure is in marked contrast to the 3.1% growth rate recorded during the July to September quarter. The deepest cuts in defence spending for 40 years, fewer exports and sluggish growth in company stockpiles have been blamed. Brazilian police say cheap fireworks meant for outdoor use started the fire which killed 235 people in a nightclub in the city of Santa Maria. The chief investigator says the band who were performing on stage used the cheap fireworks rather than buying more expensive indoor flares. Four people, including the club's co-owner and two of the band members, have been arrested. Food standards authorities in the Irish Republic believe horse meat found in beef burgers in the United Kingdom came from Poland. Britain's Food Standards Agency boss, Catherine Brown, has told the House of Commons Environment Committee that a mixture of beef and horse offcuts were contained in a frozen block of filler product imported from Poland. 10 million burgers were withdrawn from sale across all of Britain's supermarket chains after traces of horse DNA were found in samples. Investigations have begun in Poland to find out how beef and horse were mixed. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Bill, thank you very much. 1905 in Paris, 1805 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We begin in Israel. Local reports suggest a number of airstrikes in southern Lebanon and along that country's border with Syria. While the Israeli Defense Force has not confirmed its involvement, there is increasing speculation that the action may have been prompted by fears within Israel that Syrian chemical weapons could fall into the hands of groups like Hezbollah. The Israeli Prime Minister, newly re-elected, Benjamin Netanyahu, had previously suggested that his country would take action to intervene should they perceive a threat from what he described as deadly weapons in a disintegrating country. And now it seems that these concerns may have forced Israel's hand. So what are the implications of this latest probable Israeli action, and is this a turning point in the Syria crisis? Monocle contributor Daniela Pellet joins me on the line now from Jerusalem to try and answer those questions. Daniela, first of all, what do we know so far about what it is that's actually happened today?
Well, we've been piecing reports together. The Israeli media isn't allowed, due to reasons of censorship, to report directly, so they've been attributing the reports to foreign media. So this picture as we have it now is that at least three air sorties were flown over Lebanon yesterday and this morning. And there have been reports from the Lebanese side that there were a number of airstrikes. Now, this was not expected, but there's certainly the last two or three days there's been really, really heightened tensions here in Israel. The two Iron Dome missile defense batteries were deployed to the north, obviously in case that there was some sort of retaliatory strike. The military intelligence and military chiefs have been going to Washington and to Moscow. This is last-minute talks. And the rhetoric has generally been sort of bumped up quite a lot about the danger coming from Syria in the last 2 days.
Now, Israel is doesn't tend to talk about its military operations unless it really feels it has to. So this has the hallmarks of their the sort of action the IDF might take. If it is them, why would they be doing this right now? What would be their reasons?
Well, I don't think there is any doubt, really, that it was there. I mean, the Israel is described as red lines, the idea that Syrian chemical weapons, is that everyone knows Syria has a huge stock of a chemical arsenal. If they would fall into the arms of the rebels or be channeled to Hezbollah. Now, this isn't only their chemical weapons. Now they're saying it could be if they have superior conventional weapons as well. That would mean if Hezbollah had it, it would make Israel's air power significantly weaker. Now, Syria has these kinds of weapons because Russia has sold them to it. And so if Syria is now passing these weapons on to Hezbollah, there's serious implications for the region.
Now, so far during the Syria crisis, Israel, certainly from a security point of view, has benefited to a certain extent. You know, Syria is one of their enemies, and Syria is weak, has its own issues. It hasn't been able to provide the support to Hezbollah and its other allies in Lebanon that it has in the past. Does this suggest that there's actually a turning point now, that members of the security forces within Israel believe that actually this is entering a new, slightly more dangerous phase?
Well, nobody wants escalation on the northern border. I don't think Hezbollah wants it either, because they've got quite enough problems of their own trying to keep. I mean, they are also a political party, and they're trying to keep Lebanon ticking along as well. But certainly, that the feeling here is is of heightened worry. In the last month, a lot more Israelis have been going to renew their gas masks and their chemical weapon kits. So I think there is a feeling that if trouble is coming, the army and the population want to be ready for it. But we're far from being on the brink of an all-out conflict, I would say that.
You mentioned gas masks there and ordinary people stocking up on them. What does this sort of thing do for ordinary Israelis? I mean, how does it affect their lives?
Well, there's a strange phenomenon here in Israel. When there's some sort of outside threat, it really ignites this idea that everyone's going to pull together. And that's a perceived threat, and that's a real threat. And we saw in the escalation in Gaza only a couple of months ago, when there were missiles falling in Israel, you know, as far as up as Tel Aviv, there was definitely an atmosphere in the country of a national crisis and everyone being united. But there's heightened tensions and there's an expectation that something might happen. But I think people feel fairly relaxed about the idea that the northern border is going to stay quiet for a little while longer.
And looking at the political ramifications, I mean, is this sort of action something that's likely to have wide political support across the spectrum?
Well, it's hard to predict. I mean, there have been some cynical voices saying, well, Ehud Barak is the outgoing defence minister. He's not going to be... He didn't run again in the election, so he announced his withdrawal from politics. And some cynical voices have been saying, look, this is his last gasp. And the officials in the foreign ministry have also been saying, well, this is nothing. There's nothing really going on. This is Netanyahu ramping up tensions for political reasons. But I think that's a little bit far-fetched. You know, that we are in coalition discussions at the moment, and Netanyahu is having a real task ahead of him, building a new coalition. But I think the general idea is to try and keep things calm, keep things stable. Israel isn't boasting about what it's done. It doesn't want an escalation. It doesn't really want to give Hezbollah a casus belli to retaliate.
And just finally, on the issue of Hezbollah and what it does next, obviously it's been weakened somewhat by the fact that its biggest supporter, the Assad regime, has not been able to give it the support that it's wanted over the last 18 months or so. Is there a feeling that Hezbollah needs to sort of work out what it does next if the Syrian regime does crumble?
Well, it's not just the pressure from Syria as well. There's a lot of pressure on Iran, and I think from the Israeli perspective, they see Iran as the potentially a loser from the Syrian crisis. If Iran is no longer being able to sponsor Syria, no longer able to sponsor Hezbollah. I mean, already we've seen tensions with Hamas that had to move out of its Damascus base. So certainly from the Israeli perspective, this is going to put much greater pressure on Hezbollah.
Daniela Peled in Jerusalem, thank you very much indeed. Up next, is Angela Merkel in trouble? This is Midori House.
The menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks and the makers behind these experiences. Each week we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries and, of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition, we find out about the merits of urban beekeeping in Berlin. We visit an area of Seoul that has shaken its criminal reputation to become a hotspot for international restaurants. And we talk about a new trend, which has people pairing their hot dogs with a glass of champagne.
Champagne goes very well with fatty food because the acidity of champagne cuts through the fat content and it's extremely satisfying.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Sichuan was one of China's poorest provinces until investment from Beijing and abroad brought boom time to its capital. Monocle's video journalist Gabriel Li paid a visit to Chengdu to gauge the progress.
Here the changes are radical. This has become a much more international city, and every day you see it growing more and more. This is the new market inside of China, which is it's not a market itself, it's a continent. Foreign companies that want to sell something in China, now they're trying to come here. And you can see they're coming here.
Chengdu, the new China, in the Films menu on monocle.com.
At 19:15 in Berlin, 18:15 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. To Germany now. And just a couple of weeks ago, German Chancellor Angela Merkel could look forward to September's election with some confidence. Her party, the Christian Democrats, were riding high in the polls. Ms. Merkel's own popularity remained overwhelmingly positive, and the opposition Social Democrats were struggling to break through. But a surprise defeat in Lower Saxony a week ago has shaken things up somewhat. A new poll now shows the Social Democrats and their probable coalition partners, the Greens, almost neck and neck with the Christian Democrats. Quentin Peel is a Financial Times Berlin correspondent, and a little earlier he explained the change in fortunes.
They've certainly picked up a point here and a point there in the polls, and I think for the first time in a while, people are suddenly saying, well, maybe a red-green government of Social Democrats and Greens might be an alternative to Angela Merkel. Having said which, they're still not there. They're not getting an outright majority, even over Ms. Merkel's Christian Democrats. They're really neck and neck, and everything depends on the Liberals in Germany, who are very weak at the moment, down around 4%. If they can get 5%, then it looks like Angela Merkel's home and dry. Whatever happens, though, this race is now more open than it was.
Now, 5% for the Liberals is crucial, because if you don't get 5%, then you can't enter Parliament. So if the Free Democrats don't reach that threshold, who does Angela Merkel have to turn to as potential coalition allies?
Well, the first and most obvious would be the Social Democrats themselves. That's what the Germans would call a grand coalition of the big party of the right, the Christian Democrats, and the big party of the left, the Social Democrats. And that was the government that Angela Merkel had last time, before her present government. So from 2005 to 2009, she ruled with the Social Democrats. And by all accounts, she really rather liked it. She got on rather well. The Social Democrats didn't like it, because they came out of it and promptly did really rather badly in the elections. So they were always the junior partner, and I don't think they enjoyed that. Now, if the Social Democrats said, no, we're not going to rule with you, she can turn to the Greens, and that would be a very interesting government, because it's what they call in Germany black-green, black for the Christian Democrats on the right and green for the Greens. And the Greens are this very interesting party, where parties very conservative. They don't want to change things. They don't want fast economic growth. They want to really go back to the horse and cart. At the same time, they've also got rather a left-wing tradition on social policy and such. So it wouldn't be a comfortable government, and they've never actually tried it before. And that would really be an interesting experiment.
And it's possible as well that there would be some crossover when it comes to energy policy between Ms. Merkel and the Greens.
Yes, certainly. I mean, the one thing that Ms. Merkel has been very clever about is she's been occupying the centre ground of German politics, and she's grabbed everybody else's policies as she's gone along. So when last year she suddenly announced a U-turn on nuclear energy, that she was going to get out of nuclear energy by 2021, that really took the main policy away from the Greens, or at least put them on the same page. So that's where she's on the same place as the Greens. And as for the Social Democrats, she suddenly seized on having a minimum wage policy. And that's been their big sort of stick with which they've been beating the government. The government has no minimum wage policy. So again, she's been very clever at occupying the middle ground.
Now, you say she's very clever at occupying the middle ground. Do you think she is by nature a centrist, an ideological centrist, if such a thing is possible, or she's merely sort of willing to sort of make whatever compromises she thinks are necessary to improve her chances of staying in power?
She's a pragmatist, which means she's prepared to make compromises to stay in power. And I think she's also instinctively pretty much in the middle ground. She's not a real conservative. And I think that's something that worries her own party. The Christian Democrats say, you know, where's the conservatism in this chancellor? Where is the devotion to family values? And really conservative attitudes that they feel she's rather betrayed. So the irony of the situation is her popularity, and she's still very popular, the ratings are over 60%. Her popularity is pulling her party up, but her party feels uncomfortable because they don't think she's conservative enough. So it's a real tension on her own side of the equation.
And let's just end with a word about Peer Steinbrück, the SPD's candidate who's going to be challenging Angela Merkel for the chancellorship. When he was first chosen, lots of people praised him, said, yes, they've made the right choice. This is going to be interesting. He hasn't had the smoothest of rides, though, so far. Do you think that in recent weeks he has turned a corner? Do people look at him and think, yes, that person can be the next chancellor?
I think he's still having a pretty rocky time. I mean, the very first thing that happened to him when he was nominated as the candidate was that he got into a great row about the speaker's fees he'd been taking, talking to a lot of bankers and businessmen for really very substantial fees that doubled his parliamentary income. And he didn't seem to be in the least bit ashamed about it. And then he got into another row about saying that the Chancellor wasn't paid enough money. And it sounded like he was saying, I want more money if I ever become Chancellor. All of these things didn't fit in with the image of his party as the socially caring left-wing party. Now, he is seen as competent, and that's what he's been put there for. But I think he's still having a very rocky time because Angela Merkel is the one who picks up the brownie points, if you like, for being the caring, feeling chancellor, which is supposed to be the advantages of the Social Democrats. And Steinbrück is seen as something of an abrasive character. He's got a very sharp tongue. So he's trailing way behind. As I was saying, Angela Merkel's popularity is up above 60%, and his is under 30%. So there is an awful lot to catch up there.
That was Quentin Peel, the FT's Berlin bureau chief, talking to me a little earlier today. Up next, we'll be heading to Ukraine for a story of political intrigue that reads more like something from the pages of a thriller. It was a story that rocked the Ukraine and read like a political murder mystery. A former police chief was accused of killing a well-known journalist, but he said he was acting on orders from the country's late interior minister. There were also secret recordings that implicated the president at the time, Leonard Kushma. Those secret recordings were later found to be inadmissible in court because they were obtained illegally. It was a case that gripped the country. But now, after a lengthy court case, a judge has found Oleksiy Pukach, the former police chief, guilty of murdering journalist Georgi Gongadze in 2000. Pukach will be sentenced to life in prison. Despite the court judgment, the ruling will do very little to answer a swirl of questions and conspiracy theories. Earlier today, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck spoke to our regular contributor Gulliver Cragg, who's currently in Poland.
First of all, this journalist, did he have secret information about the government? Why do people feel that he was the target of this killing?
Well, Georgi Gongadze was the founder of Ukrainska Pravda, which is, and still is today, an internet newspaper which really dishes the dirt on corruption in Ukraine. It is the number one source in Ukraine for investigative journalism. And so I think that his founding of that newspaper and the investigations that he carried out for that newspaper very much riled the regime of the then president, Leonid Kuchma. And he was murdered only a few months after the newspaper was founded. And a lot of Ukrainians really believe that it was the president, Leonid Kuchma, in collaboration with Volodymyr Litvin, another high-ranking politician who has been Speaker of Parliament in Ukraine. I think right now he's just only an MP. A lot of Ukrainians think that it must have been them who originally ordered it, and that these tapes made by Kuchma's then bodyguard, Melnichenko, kind of proved that in a way. But the problem is that, you know, judicially, they're not admissible. And the one person in this whole story who might have been the witness who could have testified and really implicated Kuchma and Litvin in this is Yuri Kravchenko. He, when he was supposed to testify in this case in 2005, committed suicide with two bullets to the head. A lot of Ukrainians think it's a bit strange that somebody managed to shoot himself in the head twice, and therefore that suicide is also considered very suspect.
Now, Oleksiy Pukach actually even said yesterday that, in fact, it shouldn't be him that would face any trial. It should be the former Interior Minister and Leonid Kuchma, the former president.
At the end of the ruling, he said, the judge asked him, did he understand the sentence? And he said, I will understand the sentence when Kuchma and Litvin are in jail beside me. That was his, and I quote.
Now, we've seen, unfortunately, over the past couple of years that the judiciary in the Ukraine is actually quite politically motivated at times, and you don't always get the sense that the right people are going to jail. What's your reading of what's happened here? Is it the case that, you know, they've found one person guilty, but they won't dare turn the spotlight on the kind of the real power structure in Ukraine? Or is this in some way a political judgment?
Well, I think it is actually quite problematic to prove Kuchma and Litvin's involvement because of the fact that these tapes made by Melnichenko have been deemed inadmissible. I don't know if it's possible to go back on that judgment. He was the bodyguard of Leonid Kuchma, the president. He made these recordings and he sought asylum in the United States. So in the United States, when he made these recordings public, there's been doubt cast on whether or not they're genuine or whether they could have been faked. And there's the problem of the admissibility in any court of recordings made illegally. And so I think that the question of whether or not it would actually be possible to prove in any other way without the... If the tapes are inadmissible and Yuri Kravchenko's evidence is... I mean, well, Yuri Kravchenko is no longer with us. It means that it's going to be quite hard to prove the involvement of anyone higher up than Pukach. All we have is Pukach's repeated and consistent insistence that this murder was ordered by Leonid Kuchma and Volodymyr Litvin.
Now, there seems to be no sense of closure even after the completion of this trial. I see that Gongadze's widow has said that she intends to appeal because she felt that the truth hadn't come out. And actually, for the country as a whole, there never seems to be any resolution to its past woes, does there?
No, I don't think this certainly doesn't bring closure to anyone. I think Georgi Gongadze will appeal. Pukas also wants to appeal against this. This will go on, but one Ukrainian political expert said it's probably unlikely to go anywhere until after the next election. If Viktor Yanukovych loses the presidential election in 2015. Then the incoming opposition authorities may well seek to reopen the case and to try to prove Kuchma's involvement. The thing is, though, that for probably a majority of Ukrainians, it was Kuchma who ordered it, and people feel very clear about that. This murder sparked waves of protest from 2000, when it took place, up until 2004, when it culminated, as it were, in the Orange Revolution, which ousted Leonid Kuchma's candidate for the presidency, which prevented Viktor Yanukovych, who was then Kuchma's candidate for the presidency, from being elected. He, of course, made his comeback and is now in power, but I don't think that changes much with regard to Ukrainian view of Leonid Kuchma.
That was Gulliver Cragg speaking to our editor, Andrew Tuck.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To via Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
News is next, but first, this is Beaver by Rolga. That was Beaver by Rolga. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be talking about Bilbao, a bit of Bolshoi Ballet, and a Blackberry Bonanza. And that's just the bees. But first, keeping it alliterative, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
Israeli jets have attacked a suspected weapons convoy on the border of Syria and Lebanon. Reports say the strike happened overnight as the convoy was on its way into Syria. Three squadrons of four jets carried out three separate sorties against the convoy. Police have charged a British man with the stabbing to death of a mother of three in the south of France. A search was launched after 34-year-old Yudia Zimat failed to collect her three-year-old daughter from school in Nîmes. 32-year-old Robert Plant was arrested after police carried out house-to-house inquiries. The United Nations World Food Programme is calling on the international community to help save hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees from hunger. The Syrian Arab Red Crescent says more than 2.5 million Syrians inside the country need food assistance. Police have gathered near a house in rural Alabama where a man's believed to be holding a 6-year-old child hostage in an underground shelter. The standoff has been going on throughout the night after the man, whose name has not been released by police, boarded the school bus she was on in Midland City and shot the driver dead. The US economy shrank by an equivalent annual rate of 0.1% in the last quarter of 2012. It's the first contraction announced by the US Commerce Department since the 2009 global recession. The figure's in marked contrast to the 3.1% growth rate recorded during the July to September quarter. Brazilian police say cheap fireworks meant for outdoor use started the fire which killed 235 people in a nightclub in the city of Santa Maria. 4 people, including the club's co-owner and 2 of the band members, have been arrested. Food standards authorities in the Irish Republic believe horse meat found in beef burgers in the United Kingdom came from Poland. Britain's Food Standards Agency boss Catherine Brown has told the House of Commons Environment Committee that a mixture of beef and horse offcuts were contained in a frozen block of filler product imported from Poland. And those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Bill, thank you very much indeed. 1932 in Bilbao, 1832 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And we shift our sights now to Bilbao because earlier this month, the City Mayor's Foundation awarded its 2012 World's Best Mayor Prize to Iñaki Azkuna. He's the long-serving, forward-thinking and much-loved mayor of Bilbao, credited with transforming the city from a declining industrial hub to a thriving centre for culture. Our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous travelled up north to the Basque Country to congratulate him in person. The two of them sat down to lunch at the mayor's favourite local restaurant to talk about the city's transformation and the personal trademarks of his term in office.
I've just sat down for lunch with Bilbao Mayor Iñaki Azkuna at one of his favourite restaurants. His modest smile is perhaps the only concession he's willing to give of being genuinely humbled since being named the world's best mayor. While the city's metamorphosis has pleased residents and somewhat unnerved traditional rival San Sebastian, this tireless mayor shows no sign of slowing down.
I've been mayor for 14 years, and I think I've done enough to internationalise Bilbao. Because while one must live with one's neighbours, one also has to travel. People must get to know us. It is important that we are known outside of Spain.
And Bilbao is known outside of Spain, something which seemed unfathomable a decade ago. Mayor Azkuna set out to change the city from an industrial city into a cultural epicentre. Many of the plans had already been set in motion. The relocation of the city's river port, 14 kilometres away to the coastline, created a superport within the city's reach, but also freed up urban real estate and liberated the river from the stranglehold of factories on its banks, cleansing waters once clogged with industrial waste. The second part of the plan was to utilise this free space to attract big-ticket cultural projects, co-financed with both private and public money.
Nosotros hemos trabajado en el corto plazo.
We've worked on short-term issues that would have an immediate effect on residents, such as street cleaning, such as the gardens, such as the general welfare of the people. But we've also worked on long-term projects that have been built in Bilbao, such as the Guggenheim Museum, the Alhóndiga de Bilbao, the Museum of Fine Arts, the Eos Kaiduna Palace of Exhibitions and Music. These are all fixtures that will last hundreds and hundreds of years.
Todo eso son inmuebles para cientos, cientos años. El problema que me pregunta mucha gente.
The problem, which many people ask me in Bilbao, and this will surely be one of your questions, is how we manage to invest so much in the city and also have zero debt. Well, the investment in Bilbao has been an amalgamation of efforts to complete these ideas and projects.
Uniendo ideas y proyectos. Y además de eso, hemos seguido.
And apart from pursuing mutual investment, we followed not the theory of any Nobel laureate in economics, but our grandmother's theory, that with the money you have, use a little bit now and pay off your debts to your neighbour. And so we paid off our debts to our neighbours, and in 10 to 12 years' time, we'll have removed all the city's debt.
Nos hemos quitado toda la deuda del ayuntamiento.
It's not just the mayor's knack for financial management that has allowed him to consistently bask in glowing opinion polls. It's his ability to manage and solve problems. I was fortunate enough to experience this efficiency firsthand. Having arrived in Bilbao slightly under the weather, I apologise for my lack of appetite during the interview. Unperturbed, he continued to answer my questions, but with a few hand movements and calls to his aides, managed to arrange the delivery of some flu medicine to the table within a few minutes. It was an impressive gesture, but not surprising seeing as Mayor Azcuna is a former doctor, a caring profession which has undoubtedly helped him forge a close relationship with his constituents.
Al principio, cuando me hicieron alcalde, me dijeron que era muy elitista.
At first, when I became mayor, they said I was too elitist because I read a lot of literature and I like opera and music, and I was told that this was very elitist. But people soon saw that, while I liked the opera and literature, I'm a very approachable man. I think I'm a very approachable man. And that I tackled the problems of the residents if I was able to, although sometimes there are times that I cannot solve them. I believe that the characteristics of the city council during my term have been my closeness and transparency. As far as transparency is concerned, my city has been number one or number two in Spain. Spain, as I said before, has a crisis because it's grieving from its former sins, the sins of believing that it was rich. Spain needs to lose weight. It has to be more austere.
Yet the mayor isn't as fond of austerity only as other Spanish politicians right now. He believes there needs to be a two-tiered approach, cutting back on frivolous spending, but also investing in the future, particularly in the young unemployed. For this, he argues, a bailout will be necessary. Money which, if targeted correctly, could help to reduce Spain's massive unemployment queue, which is soon expected to be 6 million people long. Tackling local and national issues aren't the only challenges on his plate, however. And as he talks about his personal struggles, the fortitude of this mayor is even more astounding.
My wife died in September, and I've been battling prostate cancer for 10 years. And this bothers me quite a bit. But I'm still eager to continue to keep working for the city, directing the destiny of Bilbao, and doing whatever is possible to make it a great city.
Y haciendo lo posible porque Bilbao sea una gran ciudad. Pues debe ser misteriosa.
But my source of strength is a mystery. I don't know. I'm a man who's always had discipline. I'm internally disciplined. I'm a believer. I believe in the transcendence of life, and I think that in life we have a responsibility and a social conscience. You can have fun, but responsibly and with a commitment, and I have committed to my city, and I will have commitment until I fizzle out, a commitment to my people. My people have given me confidence, and I have that commitment, and it gives me strength. I don't take any special pill for that.
No tomo ninguna pastilla especial para eso.
That was the mayor of Bilbao, Iñaki Azcuna, talking to Liam Aldous. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a little bit of music.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive and savour.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
And you're back with Midori House, 1842 here in London, 10:42 a.m. in Los Angeles. It was Burns Night last week, and a celebration of all things Scottish. And as such, I've had this song stuck in my head ever since then. I'd like it to be stuck in yours as well. This is Bern Sebastian, Sleep the Clock Around. That was Belle and Sebastian with Sleep the Clock Around. 1846 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And now, for generations in Russia, the ballet was one of the most obvious symbols of the upper classes. And its two imperial troops, the Mariinsky and the Bolshoi, were those most closely associated with the Tsars and ruling classes. But once the Soviet authorities took charge of ballet, as they did with all other artistic forms, these legendary institutions were forced into dramatic change. Christina Ezrahi has written a new book, Swans of the Kremlin, which documents this remarkable conflict and the unlikely triumphs that the Bolshoi and the renamed Kirov went on to enjoy. Christina, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. How difficult was it to actually gain access and insight into the inner workings of these institutions, given their difficult history during the Soviet era?
Good evening, Steve. Well, I decided to base my research on written records. I did a lot of background interviews just to get a sense of the atmosphere of the companies during the Soviet period. But one of the beauties of the Soviet period for the historian is that this was really a paper-obsessed regime. So a lot of the important discussions which were being held at the theaters were recorded, so there are verbatim records of debates held at the theaters, their correspondences with the Ministry of Culture, and all of these papers are basically lying in very big state archives in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And I went to the archives and was lucky enough to get access, and that is really the story. It was very exciting.
And when you got the access, I mean, what stories did you uncover? I mean, what sort of changes did they have to go through to ensure that they stayed in favor?
Well, my book is it's really about the complex relationship between art and power in the Soviet Union, and it's ultimately really a book that shows that art is stronger than politics, because what is so interesting is that these artists, of course, had no choice but to accept the demands that the Soviet system was making on them, which basically, in the case of ballet, meant that the authorities kept on saying, you cannot really represent a peasant state, I mean a socialist state, supposed to build communism with these ballets about princes and princesses and kings and queens. You have to create ballets on Soviet life. And that was not something that most artists were terribly keen on, or most audience were terribly keen to see. But what is really interesting is that some choreographers actually managed to use this demand of the regime to do artistically very innovative work. So they would tell the regime, we're doing a ballet on a Soviet topic, but then what they actually managed to do artistically on stage was much, much more interesting and really went beyond the ideological message that they were supposed to send. So it's ultimately an area that shows that artists, if they want to, can really find a way to manipulate or outwit the ideological controls which are being imposed on them.
And also, were there compromises, concessions, which the Soviet regime were willing to make when they realised that, you know, a simple purge or forcing the Bolshoi and the Kirov to make real changes could have had a real impact on how successful they were?
It really depends what years we're talking about here. Of course, by far the most difficult period was the Stalin period. And if choreographers or dancers did something at the companies which the regime didn't like, then they would simply be forced into creative silence or worse. There was a choreographer who did a ballet which was supposed to depict life on a collective farm, but the regime thought that it was making fun of life on a collective farm, so this choreographer was really not able to stage very much until the end of the Stalin period. So under Stalin it would have been very difficult, but later on it is true that by the 1950s and 1960s, Soviet ballet had really become in many ways the cultural calling card of the regime. So dancers and choreographers also got access to very high politicians and could sometimes use these connections for their own benefit. So if they wanted to get something done, if they wanted to go on tours, which they were not allowed to, for example, the famous Bolshoi ballerina Maya Plissetskaya wasn't allowed to go on tour, so she in the end got the help of Khrushchev to actually give her the permission to go abroad. So, in other words, dancers in later years could use political patronage for their purposes as well. So it wasn't just a one-way street of political suppression. They could also use this for their purposes at times.
Now, Christine, you've been slightly fortunate, I guess, with the timing of your book coming out, in that, you know, even today, the story of the Bolshoi continues to fascinate. With all the sorts of with the current controversy we've seen with the acid attack on the director, and with ballerinas fleeing. Why do you think that? You know, what is it you think that makes the Bolshoi such a hotbed of intrigue?
To be honest, I think it is its location in Moscow, because what I've been talking about so far is really, and what I'm looking at in my book is probably, I suppose, the positive side of the story. I'm taking it as a given that any artist is, of course, a child of their times and a child of their political, economic and social surroundings, of the general climate in the country. But in the past, we've seen that art is ultimately stronger than politics. However, of course, artists and artistic institutions cannot help but reflect general currents in the country that they're located at. And what we've seen in Moscow in the post-Soviet period is really blurring. I mean, it's a very glamorous city. It's an incredibly exciting city, but it's also a city where the dividing line between politics, business and the underworld can sometimes become somewhat thin, and I think we have to be very careful here, because the attack on Sergei Filin, the artistic director of the Bolshoi, is of course an absolute tragedy, and he is really to be admired to continue working from his hospital bed like he is. But we don't know yet who perpetrated this.
No, indeed. Well, perhaps let's leave it there. Christina Ezrahi, author of Swans of the Kremlin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Ot London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
1853 here in London, 1353 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, keen-eyed watchers of the tech market will know that today was a pretty important one for Research in Motion, although we can't actually call them that anymore. At the much-anticipated unveiling of their new BlackBerry 10 device, Chief Executive Torsten Hines made another revelation that the company would from now on be known as BlackBerry, abandoning the RIM moniker that the company has retained since 1985. But can such new labels and, perhaps more importantly, new technology arrest the decline in fortunes that has beset this one-time aspiring market leader? David Phelan, I'm pleased to say, is here in the studio, and he's not alone. He's brought the new... have you brought the Z10 or the BB10?
The Z10, yes.
The Z10, OK. Tell us about... First of all, before we get on to the fact it's called BlackBerry, which we'll get on to in a moment, the Z10... How important is it that they get this right?
I think it's very important. They've lost a lot of market share. They've lost share price, although it has regained recently. And they need to be able to get this right to get the customers back on board that they've lost. So they've chosen hardware that I think is very attractive. I've just put it next to an iPhone, and you can see there is a kind of cursory similarity to
there
it.
Is. I'm happy. It's a little bit heavier, perhaps, though, or looks a slightly bigger.
It is. It's got a slightly bigger screen. And indeed, I did see it before the iPhone came out, so I can confirm it wasn't copied or anything. What they have got to do here, and I think are doing, is creating a new kind of software which will be, they hope, as appealing as the Apple one, though it's certainly very different. You don't have to do that thing that a lot of Apple users find fiddly, which is when you're in an app and you want to go to another one, you have to go back to the home screen and then into another app. You just slide to the side and you see what the other things are that are waiting for you. You don't have to leave an app to be able to check your Facebook or to check an email that's just come in. You stay in the app you're in.
Now, in a sense, is there a problem for BlackBerry, as the company is now known, that this is all a little bit too late? Because over the last 2 or 3 years in particular, they've lost a lot of their customers.
Sure. Their argument is that 2 years ago, they realized that they got to the end of the road with their software. They needed new software, and they bought a company to create a whole new thing. And that took 2 years until now. Now, I thought that if they didn't get it out by last September, they'd be sunk. But actually, not that much has happened since September. So they're in as good a place as they were then.
Or as bad a place.
Yes, absolutely. It is late. The big problem for them was BYOD, this thing, bring your own device to work, where company managers said to their staff, yes, use your iPhone for your emails. Brilliant. We don't have to buy everyone a BlackBerry anymore. But not very good for security. Today is the day that all around the world, CIOs, chief information officers, are punching the air with delight because they've got secure but still good-looking devices that they can persuade their staff to use.
Now, the name change, I mean, this in a sense was quite long overdue, because Research in Motion, or RIM, as it was unfortunately called by everyone, wasn't really ideal. I mean, everyone called it BlackBerry, and you have to say Research in Motion, the company that makes BlackBerries.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it was a lot. We, you and I especially, spent a lot of wasted airtime saying all that. Well, we've yes. saved all that time now, and that's good. And that seemed to be a very big deal as far as the announcements were concerned, along with the naming of Alicia Keys as a Global Innovation Director. That was a very big
right.
thing.
A Global Innovation
yeah,
Director.
She's got a job at BlackBerry, and she was great, actually. She came on and talked about how she used to be in a long-term relationship with BlackBerry. Then she saw some, as she described them, hotter, cuter phones at the gym, and then she drifted off with them. She played the field, but now she's in a long-term relationship with BlackBerry again.
But what about for those of us that were in a long-term relationship with BlackBerry, ditched them quite recently,
sure,
and are now in a long-term relationship with a younger, cuter model? Are we really going to go back?
Well, it is a good phone. The software is fantastic. It's absolutely industry-leading. Whether it's going to be enough to turn people away from the iPhones that they love, the Android phones that they love, I don't know. But for sure, if this software and hardware was announced by Apple today, it would do tremendously.
David Phelan, thank you very much indeed. David obviously has an iPhone as well as his BlackBerry as well. That's all we've got time for on today's show. The show was produced by Tom Edwards. The researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The studio manager was Alex Funnell. Next up is The Entrepreneurs, where we'll meet the CEO of Wantful, the company that's turned the chore of finding the perfect gift into an artful business model.
It's almost impossible to get wrong. You come to the site, you tell us a little bit about the person you're buying a gift for, what are they interested in, what's their sense of style, and then we help you pull together a collection of 12 perfectly suited products at that price point.
And in 3 hours' time, Tyler Brulé and Hugo McDonald will be back for the Monocle Daily. That's all for Midori House, though. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.